This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, July 14th, 2014. I'm Kyle Kellums. Support for KUAF comes from the Birth Center of Northwest Arkansas, serving Fayetteville, Rogers, Bentonville, and surrounding communities. The Birth Center offers a family birthing experience utilizing certified nurse midwives for pregnancy, childbirth, and newborn needs, and alternative pain management. More information is available at bcnwa.com. Support also comes from the Walmart Amp presenting Steely Dan Thursday, July 24th at 7:30 p.m. This American jazz and rock band, founded by Walter Becker and Donald Fagen, will perform hits like Reelin' in the Years, My Old School, Peg, and more. Tickets and information are available at amptickets.com or 443-5600. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, more than 3,000 children are in Arkansas foster care custody on any single day. A new report has suggestions how to better serve these young people. Plus, Arkansas native Louis Jordan's foray into the Caribbean and Calypso. That piece of musical history is today's edition of Arkansongs. And we'll hear how the four men running for governor of Arkansas responded when asked about the legality of same-sex marriage. First, new figures show the number of people enrolled in health care coverage through Arkansas's private option declined by about 4,800 people last month to 184,000. Arkansas Department of Human Services spokeswoman Amy Webb says inaccurate federal information about enrollment eligibility was one reason for the decline. She says another is that some enrollees saw a rise in income, leaving them ineligible for the program.
Medicaid felt it was more accurate to report at the end of the month who was eligible and exclude those individuals who had had life changes or other things where they were no longer eligible for the private option.
DHS also indicates the per-month cost per enrollee declined slightly while still remaining above last year's projections. The private option provides Arkansans living below 138% of the federal poverty level with government-funded private health insurance. The Fayetteville City Council tomorrow night is scheduled to formally accept two grants from the Walton Family Foundation for trail construction and trail design in South Fayetteville. Matt Mahalovich, the city's trails coordinator, says the larger grant for more than $800,000 will go toward completing the Town Branch Trail, which will be built in three phases.
The first piece that we'll work on is from where the Frisco Trail currently ends, where we newly extended it into Walker Park. And so it'll go from that point through Walker Park, past 15th Street, and then head back to the west along the Town Branch Creek. Underneath School Avenue, there's actually some trail construction under South School currently between that and Great House Springs Park. So that piece will all be tied in. And the next phase is from Great House Springs Park over to Razorback Road, and that's where the Crown Apartments is. And then the following phase will be from the Crown Apartments up around, kind of along the east side of Interstate 49 and back around to catch the Chalagee Trail near Hollywood Street.
He says recent additions to the city's trail system present a favorable opportunity for expanding the network of hard surface trails into an underserved part of town.
The Frisco Trail that we just completed with the tunnel under MLK has really opened up everything to the south. Before, we had this barrier with MLK to connect our trails south of there. So now we're kind of free and open, and so some really nice corridors in that part of town, and also, you know, a lot of people living there. There's the Research Technology Park for the university. And then also, ultimately, our big goal is to get the trails extended on down to the regional park that'll be along Cato Springs Road.
And for that project, the city is expected to formally accept another grant from the Walton Family Foundation of about $150,000 to cover design and engineering costs of the Cato Springs Trail, which, when completed in a few years, will connect to the regional park and to the soft surface trails at Mount Kessler. A side note, the city is officially opening the new trailhead for the Mount Kessler trails with a ribbon cutting tonight. Instances of infection by one particular waterborne bacteria are up this year. According to the Arkansas Department of Health, the Shigella bacterium has been a problem not only in Arkansas, but throughout the rest of the country as well. Dr. Gary Wheeler is the medical director for the health department's infectious disease branch.
It causes a diarrhea syndrome that's typically self-limited, meaning you don't have to do anything. It just goes away on its own, typically within about a week. There are some episodes in certain individuals that can be more severe and lead to blood in the diarrhea and sometimes to hospitalization. The hospitalization can occur because the patient becomes dehydrated or that they develop complications of the Shigella, typically more severe bowel disease, but other things as well.
Dr. Wheeler says patients who are hospitalized because of Shigella typically have other health issues like chronic illness or happen to be undergoing other treatments like chemotherapy. He also says Shigella can occur in three groups of people commonly susceptible to illness: infants, the elderly, and pregnant women. Dr. Wheeler says because Shigella lives in the GI tract, it typically spreads when people don't practice good hand hygiene. Dr. Wheeler says there's no definitive reason why the number of cases of Shigella has been on the rise this year, but he does recommend anyone with symptoms of the illness, such as diarrhea, fever, or dehydration, visit their physician. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals play the second of four home games against Tulsa tonight in Springdale. Last night, the Nats defeated the Drillers 5-1 to keep their lead in the Texas League North standings at one game. Tonight's contest is scheduled to begin at 7:05. Mostly cloudy tonight, a slight chance of showers in the early evening. Lows will be from 60 in northwest Arkansas to the mid-60s tonight for the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, mostly sunny. Highs from 77 to 82. Not bad for mid-July. And then tomorrow night, partly cloudy. Lows around 51 in northwest Arkansas. Lows in the lower 60s tomorrow night for the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. A new report issued by Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families reveals the state's foster care system would better serve children by allowing them to stay with their family of origin. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich recently talked with the report's author, and she has this report.
The 10-page report is titled Reducing the Number of Children Who Enter the Foster Care System. It's the first of a three-part study on foster care in Arkansas. Jennifer Ferguson, Deputy Director at Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, is the study's lead author.
Let's see. Well, what we looked at was a five-year period, and over that five-year period, approximately 18,500 children entered the foster care system, and it was for a variety of reasons. It could be possibly for neglect, physical or sexual abuse, parental substance abuse, parent incarceration, and for each kid that enters, there can be multiple reasons. It may just not be one of those, but it can be multiple reasons when they enter.
The Arkansas Department of Human Services took custody of an astonishing 18,469 children between July 2007 and June 2012. More than 3,200 are in the system on any given day. And according to the Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, AACF for short, far too many Arkansas kids end up in foster care. And they're finding that a majority, 93%, enter the system and stay for less than 3 years.
Their situation in Arkansas, out of the group that we looked at, almost a third returned home within a month. And it's really traumatic when you bring a child into the foster care system because in most cases they're leaving the only family they know and being placed with strangers or being placed in an emergency shelter. And so it can be really, really tough. And if so many kids are being returned home, it begs the question of, if appropriate services were put into place, could we have kept those kids at home and it wouldn't have been such a traumatic experience as they were and their families were trying to get care?
And half of all children who enter Arkansas's foster care system eventually are returned home.
And that's really the first goal of the child welfare system is to always see first if they can be reunified. And if there is a possibility, then their job is to try and put services in place so that they can be reunified.
But in order to keep more kids in their homes in the first place, Arkansas Advocate says money needs to follow the child.
Well, unfortunately, the majority of the federal funding we receive are for services while a child is in foster care and not at home. So there's just very little money that helps provide services for kids while they're in home, which doesn't make sense because obviously if you're trying to return them home and if you can keep them in their home, that's the best place for them to be. But that's the way the federal money is set up. And unfortunately, Arkansas has very little state money to pay for in-home services.
In October of 2012, Arkansas Department of Children and Family Services requested a waiver from the Fed to use current funding for initiatives to help keep kids at home. DCFS has 5 years to work out 4 major initiatives, with 2 already implemented and 2 planned. The longest running one is called Differential Response.
With that one, it means when there's a low-risk allegation, instead of it going through the foster care investigation route, being fully investigated, it's going to go to a different way through what they call Differential Response. And one of the reasons this is important is that a lot of times, since these are low-risk allegations that are being called into the hotline, they're not able to substantiate them because there's just not enough evidence there. So in the past, what that would mean was that they wouldn't be able to substantiate them, so the family wasn't eligible for any sort of services. What differential response does is it routes them a different way, and it allows DCFS to offer them some basic resources in it. And why it's important is it, or why it may help fewer kids enter the foster care system, is because it may really serve as a prevention program that if you can catch some things that are happening early and provide some resources to them, that may prevent things from escalating so that they don't end up in the foster care system. So that's a really important program, and that one has just, you know, been implemented last year, and so that's one that pretty soon we'll start seeing some evaluation data on.
The second initiative also implemented is Team Decision Making.
And it's a program that the Annie E. Casey designed, that Annie E. Casey is helping them implement, where it allows them to hopefully make immediate decisions about whether a child should be removed. And it's facilitated by an internal facilitator who's not a case-caring social worker there, which should help the process. That one is being implemented in stages right now.
The other two remain in the planning phase.
One is a new assessment tool that's called the Child and Adolescent Needs and Strengths Assessment. And I think about 25 other states use this assessment tool, but it's a better assessment in trying to prioritize the needs of a family when they come into the foster care system. So hopefully you're able to provide them the right services right away. But once again, that one's not been implemented. And then the final one is the team decision making. I'm sorry, not team decision, it's the nurturing parenting program. And there's a lot of different parenting programs out there, but I think the one that's the most important about this one, it's an evidence-based parenting program, and it's got built-in assessments so that, you know, before and during and after the program, you're able to evaluate to see if the parenting skills have improved. And so it will hopefully be a better parenting program than the ones they've been using before.
Keeping kids at home will not only help to keep families together, it will save the state money. Just one guardian, on average, receives between $400 and $500 per month in expenses, which is not a lot of money when you factor in travel, clothes, food, and medicines. Still, multiply that by 3,200 children, and you're talking $160,000 for just 1 month.
So that is the goal, that if you've got fewer kids entering the system and you're able to catch some of the things earlier, that on the, you know, long run you will be able to save some money, because that's, when it comes down to it, that's one of the things the waiver, you know, is looking at. And I think that's why it's so important, because nationally, there's other states and other groups looking at that, because there's always been the argument made that, you know, we really need to be focusing and providing more money for prevention services, because once you let problems escalate, once you let problems escalate and they do come into the system, it's much more expensive, it's much more traumatic on the child, and it's a lot tougher to be able to serve that family.
In 2013, Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families was instrumental in lobbying the state legislature to pass Act 528 to fund a home visitation program, which pairs trained professionals with new moms to cultivate best child-rearing practices. The law requires program monitoring, tracking outcomes such as improvements in maternal and infant health, family self-sufficiency, and school readiness. You can read the new foster care report and learn more about the work being accomplished by Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families by visiting aradvocates.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And in the second half hour of today's Ozarks at Large, Chuck Barrett talks about the earliest days of his career as the play-by-play voice of Razorback baseball.
You know, there was no heating or no air conditioning or anything like that in the old press box. And, you know, the air conditioning thing wasn't really an issue, but the heat in the winter was. And, you know, you'd play those games the first part of February and a lot of times on into March. It was cold. And the electricity was, you know, the way the circuits were set up probably wasn't the best in the world. But, you know, we had a little space heater in there. And when the space heater was on, it would interfere with the equipment. So in the really cold games, we would, you know, we had a 60-second break, and you'd fire that heater up, and you maybe got a good 15 seconds of heat out of it.
Chuck will still be the play-by-play voice for Arkansas football and basketball, but there will be a new voice calling baseball in 2015. We'll talk with Chuck about the move later on OAL.
I'm Robin Young. Scotland votes on independence from the UK in September, but opinion still seems to be mixed.
I would be a yes. Might as well give it a go.
I find the evidence so far very conflicting.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
NPR's Here and Now this afternoon from 1 to 3 on KUAF.
Last week, the Arkansas Press Association hosted its 2014 Super Convention at the Embassy Suites in Hot Springs. Friday, the APA hosted three debates, including one featuring the four candidates for Arkansas governor. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
You may have seen television ads for two gubernatorial candidates, Republican Asa Hutchinson and Democrat Mike Ross. But did you know there are actually four candidates running for Arkansas governor? Last Friday, Libertarian Frank Gilbert and Green Party candidate Josh Drake joined Hutchinson and Ross in Hot Springs for a debate hosted by the Arkansas Press Association. The organization streamed the event live online. On the topic of same-sex marriage, Green Party candidate Josh Drake said there is sometimes a misconception surrounding his party's stance on the issue.
The government should not tell churches what to do, and sometimes people make that mistake that we're defining what marriage is according to churches. Churches can do whatever they want to, but there's a number of government benefits that come from being married, Social Security and right to inherit. There's hundreds and hundreds of federal benefits, taxes, that have to do with being married. And our Constitution guarantees equal protection. So if the government is going to give benefits, then they have to do it equally. We can't say only people with blonde hair get this tax treatment, but dark-haired people get different. It's a fundamental tenet of our Constitution. And so that also means that if gay people want to marry, if the government is going to give benefits to heterosexual people, then equal protection means they have to give it also to gay couples.
Libertarian candidate Frank Gilbert took a similar stance on the issue of same-sex marriage.
There was few things in my life more offensive to me than when a Baptist preacher stood before my wife and I 43 years ago and our friends and family there gathered before God and man and said, by the authority vested in me by the state of Tennessee. The state of Tennessee had nothing to do with it. The state of Arkansas should have nothing to do with it. If people wish to be married, they should be married. And if they wish to register that fact with the state of Arkansas or Oklahoma or anyone else so that they can gain tax, inheritance, or other advantages, so be it. How offensive is it to have the state of Arkansas tell anyone that they must be married or that they cannot be married.
Republican Asa Hutchinson took an opposite stance on the issue. He said he supports the constitutional amendment passed by Arkansans that defines marriage as between one man and one woman. He also noted that he's waiting for an official ruling on the matter from the Supreme Court.
My understanding is the Supreme Court has not clearly ruled on that issue. I think the issue was they struck down the Defense of Marriage Act, which really related to states giving recognition to what other states do. And so I think there's still some unanswered questions on this issue that the Supreme Court has to resolve. And so I think we need to hold our breath here and have this thing work its way back up to the Supreme Court. Again, I support the Constitution of Arkansas, believing that a marriage is between one man and one woman, and we'll see what the Supreme Court says beyond that.
Democrat Mike Ross agreed with his Republican counterpart.
I am personally opposed to gay marriage. I think marriage should be between one man and one woman. That's how I consistently voted as a state senator and as a congressman. But that is not why I'm running for governor. That issue is going to be resolved by the U.S. Supreme Court. If anyone is running to try to fix that or to address that, they need to be running for the U.S. Supreme Court and not governor of Arkansas.
Ross used the rest of his allotted time on this question to discuss other matters. These remarks were made during a debate last Friday. The event was hosted in Hot Springs by the Arkansas Press Association and was streamed live online. Ross and his Republican counterpart Asa Hutchinson will participate in an hour-long debate October 7th in Little Rock. The debate will take place at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock and air on KATV Channel 7 in the Central Arkansas market, as well as on KHBS KHOG Channel 4029 in Northwest Arkansas and in the River Valley. The debate will also be streamed live on the station's websites. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
On tomorrow's edition of Ozarks, we'll hear the candidates' thoughts about the private option. Last week, the Fayetteville Shale play marked an anniversary, and two ballot proposals got closer to the November ballot. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business and Politics has the rundown on the past 7 days in Arkansas business and politics.
Although no one is baking a cake or holding a big celebration, it has now been a full decade since Fayetteville Shale leader Southwestern Energy announced in 2004 that it was taking a big chance on an undeveloped natural gas play in Arkansas. That unheralded announcement 10 years ago largely changed the state's economic fortunes during the Great Recession and hailed the emergence of the natural gas industry in the state. A University of Arkansas report said that between 2008 and 2012, oil and gas companies invested more than $12.7 billion, or 29% more than was previously forecasted. Also, nearly $2 billion in state and local taxes from permit fees and severance property, income, sales, and other taxes were collected as a result of the Fayetteville Shale activities from 2008 to 2011. That is $1.2 billion larger than projected in the 2008 study. Baptist Health broke ground Monday on a new $130 million 37-acre site in Conway. The 216,000-square-foot, 96-bed hospital will be located on the west side of I-40 in Conway. Pine Bluff-based Simmons First National says it will donate the Eudora branch of Delta Trust and Bank to Arkadelphia-based Southern Bancorp Bank. Simmons acquired Delta Trust earlier this year for $66 million. Southern Bancorp is a community development bank that works with underserved communities in the Mid-South. The transaction, terms of which were not disclosed, between Simmons First and Southern Bancorp will close by October 10th. An Arkansas trucking executive met with Vice President Joe Biden Wednesday to discuss national transportation infrastructure concerns. Steve Williams, chairman and CEO of Little Rock-based Maverick USA, was part of a White House Business Council discussion on how to address uncertainty regarding the nation's highway trust fund and other transportation issues. The trust fund is at risk for insolvency by the end of August. After more than 2 years of speculation and controversy, the Little Rock Technology Park Authority Board approved a consulting firm's recommendation to begin talks to purchase prime property in the downtown area to serve as the city's tech park headquarters. ARC Commercial and Investment Real Estate, led by Jeff Yates, presented its findings to the board on Wednesday. The location recommendation is in the 400 block of Main Street. Governor Mike Beebe named Andrew Parker of Little Rock as the newest commissioner of the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. A former staffer for Governor B.B. Parker, age 37, grew up in Little Rock and is the Director of Governmental Affairs for the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce. An initiated act to raise the state's minimum wage and a proposed constitutional amendment to allow liquor sales in all 75 counties in Arkansas both submitted more than the minimum number of signatures needed to be considered for the November ballot. Supporters for a proposal to allow for medical marijuana said they fell short of signatures to qualify. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business and Politics update.
Roby Brock's weekly updates of Arkansas business and political news are a regular Monday feature on Ozarks at Large. Support for Talk Business and Politics on Ozarks comes from AT&T, encouraging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. It is Monday, July 14th, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. With me is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. How are you doing?
It's my mama's birthday.
Well, happy birthday to her.
Happy birthday, Mom. You don't look a day over 65 and she's 95. Well, there you go. This sounds like the worst summer in the world to me.
Okay.
But they think it's awesome. Mm-hmm. Every summer, thousands of high school and college kids climb on buses with their air mattresses, their sleeping bags, their suitcases, and their trumpets or trombones or tubas. And they spend June, July, and the first part of August playing at hundreds of events across the country, culminating in a national championship in Indianapolis.
The DCI.
The DCI, Drum Corps International. They sleep in school gyms. They have like a 9-vehicle convoy for each of these groups that has a mobile kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they eat. And some days they play music for 12 hours.
Well, yeah. I mean, the public sees the evening performances.
Mm-hmm.
But for so many of them, they're practicing seemingly nonstop, mm-hmm. obviously not nonstop, but they're practicing a lot in the hot sun day after
Oh,
day.
Yeah.
No, you're right. Nothing about it sounds attractive to me.
But they
but
love
it's a high
it.
Honor.
I talked to a gentleman named Fred Morrison, who's director of the Crossman, 40-year-old mm-hmm. group that's now in San Antonio. And he was never a marching band member. His kids were. But San Antonio got a chance to sort of by the Crossman name. They had been up around Philadelphia, and they were going to disband. And so they bought the name, went and got the equipment, brought it to San Antonio, and at their first audition for 150 spots, they had 600 kids.
And the DCI is going to be here.
Yes, they are. They are going to be at Tiger Stadium in Bentonville at 7 o'clock tomorrow. It's called Music on the Move, and there are, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 competitors, and tickets start at $20 at BentonvillePride.com.
And it used to be the case, I'm not sure it still is, but the national championship mm-hmm. event used to be carried live on PBS.
Oh, wow.
From Indianapolis. I don't know if they still do that or not.
Well, it is an amazing organization and should be fascinating to watch.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas. Rhythm and blues pioneer Louis Jordan of Brinkley influenced those we consider to be R&B and rock influences themselves. Chuck Berry, James Brown, B.B. King, Bo Diddley, Ray Charles, and many more. Jordan's influence is so broad in part because he was so popular in his prime. He not only had more than 50 top 10 hits through the 1940s, many of his number one hits would stay at the top for weeks at a time. Musically, the Monroe County native is best known, then and now, for his up-tempo, near-novelty songs like Caledonia Boogie, Ain't Nobody Here But Us Chickens, Choo 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 Boogie, Five Guys Named Moe, and Saturday Night Fish Fry. But Jordan was also a great live performer, dancer, singer of ballads, and had fantastic chops on the saxophone and other horns. Another overlooked wrinkle in the talent and influence of Louis Jordan is his embrace and popularization of calypso music.
Hey, Pedro, where is Lolito?
Jordan first recorded this song early in the morning during the same sessions he recorded the show's opener, a song called Run Joe. That was in April 1947, a decade before the American calypso boom. But Jordan had long been interested in calypso music. He'd tried to accommodate immigrants from the islands who came to the clubs he played in the Northeast. From 1944, Peggy Thomas, a singer and dancer in Jordan's Timpani Five, had taught him songs from her youth in Trinidad. According to Jordan's full-length biography by John Chilton, Jordan's physician at the time solidified Jordan's decision to regularly feature Caribbean music in his sets. Dr. Walter Merrick was born in 1896 on St. Vincent Island and became a composer and historian of Caribbean music. Merrick co-wrote Run Joe with his Trinidad-born lyricist, Joe Willoughby. Jordan co-wrote Early in the Morning, and in the early 1950s, Jordan recorded this song he wrote with Willoughby called Time Marches On.
Marches on, time marches on. The young gets old and the old get cold. Time marches on. Last night, Uncle
in March 1951, Louis Jordan and his Timpani Five embarked on a successful tour of the Caribbean. Using the Myrtle Park Hotel in Kingston, Jamaica as their home base, the band flew out to play Haiti, Guyana, and Trinidad, in addition to their shows in Jamaica. Most of the shows were outdoors. The crowd knew well of Jordan's songs and yelled not only for his calypso numbers, but also his other hits. Aaron Eisenhall, Timpani Five trumpeter since the mid-1940s, called the tour the highlight of all his travels with Jordan. However, no one in the group liked the food very much.
Down the road came a junco partner. Boy, he was loaded with misery. He was knocked out loaded, and he wobbled all over the street.
Louis Jordan recorded the Caribbean-tinged version heard here of Junco Partner in 1952. Jordan continued to feature calypso numbers in his live act, recordings, and films. And who could blame him? Stone Cold Dead in the Market, his duet with Ella Fitzgerald, was number one for 5 weeks. Run Joe was number one for 2 weeks. And songs like Early in the Morning and Pushka Pishki Pie were hits and became mainstays in his set list throughout his long career. Louis Jordan died February 4, 1975. His contributions to American popular music, as well as Caribbean popular music, are still being estimated more than a century after his birth. Here in its entirety is Louis Jordan from Brinkley with Stone Cold Dead in the Market, his 1946 duet with Ella Fitzgerald.
He's stone cold dead in the market. He's stone cold dead in the market. He's stone cold dead in the market. I killed nobody but my husband.
Last night I went out drinking. When I came home I gave her a beating. So she caught up the rolling pin and went to work on my head till she bashed it in. I like old dead in the market. Stone cold dead in the market. I like old dead in the market. She killed nobody but her husband.
I lick him with the pot and the frying pan. I lick him with the pot and the frying pan. I lick him with the pot and the frying pan. And if I kill him, he had it coming, man. He's stone cold dead in the market. He's stone cold dead in the market. He's stone cold dead in the market. I killed nobody but my husband. ¶¶
family they swearing to kill her. My family they swearing to kill her.
His family they swearing to kill me. And if I kill him, he had it coming.
Yeah, like old did in the market child. Cold did in the market child. Like old did in the market. She killed nobody but her husband.
There's one thing that I am sure, he ain't going to beat me no more. So I tell you that I doesn't care if I was to die in the electric chair. Man, he's stone cold dead in the market. Stone cold dead in the market. He's stone cold dead in the market. I kill nobody but my husband.
Hey child, I'm coming back and boss you on your head one more time.
No, no, man, you can't do that. You stone cold dead in the market. Murder, stone cold dead in the market. The criminal is stone cold dead in the market. I kill nobody but my husband.
Louis Jordan of Brinkley in Monroe County with his 1946 number one duet with Ella Fitzgerald, Stone Cold Dead in the Market. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information, visit arkansongs.org.
Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, a Fayetteville company makes a prestigious list. Again.
So that enables the end user in the application, the Toyota Prius, to charge the batteries on the Prius 3 to 4 times faster than what you could with existing technology.
Arkansas Power Electrics International has, for the second time, been included on the list of 100 top technological product innovations of the past year by R&D Magazine. They're called the Oscars of Innovation. We'll have that story on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large.
On the next Fresh Air, globalization and the decline of American manufacturing. We talk with journalist Beth Macy about how the American furniture industry collapsed in the face of cheaper, subsidized Chinese products, and how one American factory owner fought to keep his business and employees afloat. Her new book is called Factory Man. Join us.
NPR's Fresh Air begins this evening at 6 on 91.3 FM.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. When the Arkansas Razorback baseball season begins next year, there will be a new voice bringing the play-by-play to listeners. This summer, Chuck Barrett, who's been handling the baseball radio broadcast for the past 23 seasons, announced he would step aside from the microphone. Chuck will still be the play-by-play voice for the Razorback football and basketball games. Last week, I caught up with Chuck and asked him about his more than two decades of calling baseball games, a relationship he began with the program when he was a young man.
I was within a week of my 29th birthday when I started. And I was working in Fort Smith and was working in radio news. And liked it very much and thought that might be what I would do for a while. And a friend of mine called me and said, the guy that's done Razorback baseball, he's not going to be back next year. And I think if, you know, you would go to work for KFAY, and part of the job would be doing Razorback baseball. This was not, there was no network or anything like that then. I just did it on the side. I think I made $40 a game that first year. And, you know, I did not have a baseball air check. And so I went out in the backyard, and so I'd have a little natural sound and just kind of let a game play out in my mind and, you know, recorded it into one of those old cassette recorders and sent them that tape, and lo and behold, they hired me.
Now, that was in the days of George Coalfield. Lights had been installed, but what was the equipment like you worked with that first season?
Well, compared to what we work with now, it was awful. I mean, back then it wasn't bad. The biggest thing was, there was no heating or no air conditioning or anything like that in the old press box. And, you know, the air conditioning thing wasn't really an issue, but the heat in the winter was. And, you know, you'd play those games the first part of February and a lot of times on into March. It was cold. And The electricity was, you know, the way the circuits were set up probably wasn't the best in the world, but, you know, we had a little space heater in there, and when the space heater was on, it would interfere with the equipment. And you could hear the buzz through the, you know, through the headsets and all that. It just didn't work, you know, all out of the same outlet, and that was the only outlet we had in there. So on the really cold games, we would, you know, we had a 60-second break, and you'd fire that heater up, and you maybe got a good 15 seconds of heat out of it. And then you'd have to shut that thing off when you came back out of the break. So I can remember doing that a lot in the first part of it, but you know, we had what we needed to get on the air. There was no ISDN. There was no, you know, and ISDN's almost become obsolete now. But there was, you know, it was a phone line and a piece of equipment that got you on the air, and that's how we did it.
Was that still Southwest Conference?
First year in the SEC.
First year in the SEC.
My first year was 92, and that was the first year in the SEC.
Did you fly to the away games?
Flew to some of them. We would fly to the far away ones. You know, I thought one of the really cool things was, you know, within the first month of doing the games, we played in a tournament up in Seattle at the King Dome. And, you know, that's, you know, that was a really cool trip. We flew to that. We would fly to South Carolina in the old days. If we played in Florida, we'd fly to that. If you played at Kentucky, you'd fly to that. But aside from those, it was, you know, it was on the bus. There were a lot of, you know, there were many, many Sundays on the road in those first probably 5-8 years when, you know, we'd pull in from Baton Rouge literally on Monday morning after a Sunday afternoon game. You'd pull in about 5 or 6 in the morning, and I'd just get off the bus, get in the car, and go to the radio station and go to work. And, but yeah, travel was not nearly what it is now.
23 years of baseball, I think it's been 8 now for football. And
7. Yeah, this will be my 8th year for football.
And then about 3 or 4 for basketball.
Yeah, I've done 4 for basketball.
Okay. People would ask me, because I was in radio, so they thought they would say, well, how does Chuck do that? Because I would figure out if a Dave Van Horn team went to Omaha, which is always the goal, right? To get to the College World Series, and by the time you're starting football, you might have seriously 3 or 4 weekends a year that were yours.
You know, in 2012, I guess it was, I think it was after my second year doing basketball. Might have been my first, I forget. Did go to Omaha, and we played, you'll remember, we were playing South Carolina for the right to get to the championship series when we were eliminated. So, and that year was one of those funny years when, you know, the 4th of July was just fell where, I think I got back from Omaha on a Saturday, and 4th of July week was starting. I think 4th of July was maybe the following Sunday that year. So, it was a long year, and I can remember after that thinking, wow, this is really a stretch. And, you know, you get back and you know, I'm ready for summer vacation now. Well, SEC Media Days is in like 2.5 weeks. So that was a long year. You want to go to Omaha. And here's the thing, and I think anyone who's been involved in it knows this, when you get to the postseason, everybody gets new life. Fans get new life, teams get new life, well, broadcasters do too, and that's when it's fun. You get to the postseason, you play in the tournaments, and there's a different atmosphere, and at that point you run on adrenaline and you're glad you're there, but it certainly makes for a long year, yes.
I'm going to make an assumption. It's more fun to be around a team that's winning than one that's not?
Oh, certainly. Absolutely. It's a lot more fun. And you know, I've seen it on both ends of the spectrum. I remember, I think in 2000, we'd won the SEC in 1999, and Norman worked so hard through the 90s to get this team up to snuff, and they went 22-8, which is really that's a heck of a record in the SEC in 99, and won it, and it was about as good as you could hope for. I mean, obviously it ended in a bad way with that regional in Fayetteville, but it was still a great year. And then the next year, I'll never forget, I mean, they lost everybody. They had nobody coming back, and a lot of the players that they'd signed opted to go pro. And I mean, they really, you know, you knew it was going to be a tough year. Well, they went to Tennessee and won the first 2 games of the series. And it was like, well, everything's going to be okay. And then they lost 18 SEC games in a row. And so, That was no fun. And but yeah, it's a lot more fun when you're with a winning team. There's no question. From a broadcast standpoint, it really doesn't matter. You can't control what happens on the field, but it sure is a lot more fun to follow a team that's winning.
It seems like your career with the Razorbacks, you've been around some really influential and special people. I think of the two baseball coaches, because only in 23 years, only two coaches, Norm DeBrine and Dave Van Horn. But then you were also connected with Paul Eales and Mike Nail, some people that were great, I would imagine, on-the-job training to learn from.
Well, that's been the best thing that's ever happened to me is the opportunity to work with those guys. And I learned from old school guys. I didn't learn from new school guys. And I don't mean to sound like a grandfather, but I didn't learn from the ESPN generation. I learned from guys that did it differently. And all those guys were great mentors. Jim Elder.
Yeah.
And Little Rock, I did a lot of work with him over the years, and he was from that school, and Paul certainly was. And I think Mike Nail is just a great broadcaster. I mean, he's a blood and guts broadcaster and lives it and loves it and did it his whole career. And I've got so much admiration for Mike as a broadcaster. And that's the luckiest thing that's happened to me is fortunately, in at least in a few brief moments, I was smart enough to shut up and just watch them. And they were wonderful people to learn from, and all quality people. And I think you'll have an appreciation for this, Kyle. There's a certain way when you, there's a certain way that, Paul talked to people that came up with him. That came up to him that made an impression on me. Even if he didn't have time, he always stopped and talked, and that made an impression on me. Mike Nail taught me the importance as a very young guy in the spring and in the summer that even if it was hot, you'd be treated a lot more professionally if you put on a pair of slacks as opposed to a pair of shorts. And just little things that I watched from these guys and learned from, just the way they handled themselves, the way they walked and talked, and all the little things that I think either make you or break you. I was really lucky in that those guys, they knew what they were doing, and I think we all have people that, we look to sometimes professionally, and we think, 20 years from now, I want to be like that guy. And so you just kind of emulate them. There's not an original thought there. You just copy what they're doing, and that's kind of what I did with those guys.
You grew up in Clarksville, correct?
That's correct.
Did you work in radio when you were in high school?
Yeah, it's really all I've ever done.
That sounds familiar.
I started when I was 16 years old. I worked at the radio station in Clarksville. I also worked at... those who remember Happy Days, I'll draw an analogy to Arnold's and the place that I worked at in high school. It was kind of that kind of place, the gathering place for all the kids. So, hey, I had a great life growing up. And I started working at the radio station when I was 16 and did the PA with the boys, the Little League ball games and stuff. And for whatever reason, I don't know what it is, but for whatever reason, I've always known this is what I would do. It's all I've ever done. It's all I know how to do. If it were to ever go, I'd be in a lot of trouble.
The relationship between a listener and a baseball play-by-play announcer grows and is something special because of the number of games, because of the rhythm of the game. I think of the folks who grew up with Jack Buck and the Cardinals, or Denny Matthews and the Royals, or Vin Scully and the Dodgers. I know you don't like to hear this sort of thing. You shudder from this. You're one of the best. I listen to a lot. You made something sound so easy that if you've ever tried to do it, you realize it's not easy at all. How did you learn to watch everything on a game? Because if people don't realize, the half innings in baseball are very short. And there's not always someone to tell you that there's been a substitution made at shortstop or a balk has been committed. If you look down to score and look up, you may miss something. How did you learn to be able to see everything?
Well, by missing stuff. just to be honest, that's the most honest thing I can say, is you learn by missing stuff. You'll ask yourself in your head, a question that you think an audience member might be asking, and, I didn't notice that. And I think when you first start out, you just learn to notice those things. Baseball is a game that's made for the radio. There's no doubt about that. It is a game that is made for the radio. And the time between pitches, you know, people always say, well, what do you talk about between pitches? Well, that's when you paint the picture. And baseball is the only sport that affords you that time. You know, ball games now, when you listen to anybody's broadcast now, I mean, you know, everything is sponsored. Everything is sponsored. You give the time on the scoreboard, it's sponsored. And, you know, you got a million and one commercial liner cards to read now. And so the opportunities to really paint the picture are eliminated dramatically by the commercialization of the games. And look, I'm not complaining because that's what pays me, and it pays for all of it. And I don't begrudge that because I understand how it works. But baseball is a game that, because of the time that elapses between pitches, affords you the time to paint the picture. And I think over time, you get a feel for the game. You mentioned something earlier that was very beneficial to me as a baseball broadcaster. I only did games for two coaches in 23 years. I knew when Norm was going to run. Mm. Just by having watched all his teams play, I know when Dave likes to start runners. Just by having watched his team play, just by talking to him, just by talking baseball with him. And that's a great, great tool for a broadcaster. And it makes you sound a lot smarter than you really are. You know, if you say, you know, if it's a 1-2 count and you know that you've talked to him before the game and you say, well, the guy likes to go to the breaking ball in the dirt on 1-2, and if we don't chase, we're going to start the runner. Well, you can say, like, you know, let's see if they start the runner right here. This might be a good time to start the runner. And then when they do, you sound like a genius. But in reality, it's just because you've been around that coach and you understand what his nuances are. And that was a great, great benefit to me doing those ball games, was because, you know, Norm and Dave are very similar in philosophy anyway. And I understood what they wanted to do. And so, you know, because of that, I was able to pick up on some things that I would not have been able to if every 4 or 5 years you're changing coaches.
Well, Chuck, congratulations on 23 years. Get some rest, and then we'll listen to you as the football season kicks off.
All right, Kyle. I appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
Chuck Barrett talked to me last week, just a few days after he announced he would no longer be the play-by-play voice of Arkansas Razorback baseball. He will continue his radio duties as the voice of the University of Arkansas football and basketball teams.
Brady stands in from the left side. Bannock's going to work from the stretch with the bases loaded. The pitch is coming, swinging a fly ball to left field, hit pretty well. Going back is Napolitan. That ball's gone! That's a great.
Chuck Barrett with the dramatic call of Brady Toop's dramatic ninth inning grand slam home run against Wichita State in the 2004 NCAA Regionals. Arkansas would eventually advance to the College World Series that season. That home run, by the way, voted by Arkansas Razorback baseball fans as the most exciting moment in the first 15 years of Baum Stadium. You can see and hear that call on YouTube. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, West Fork. Support for KUAF comes from Vetro 1925, offering classic Italian dining with a touch of sophistication. Located just off the square in Fayetteville, Chef Dirks and his staff strive to preserve simple, bold flavors using fresh ingredients. VETRO1925.com for reservations, catering, and private party information and more. Fayetteville Public Library continues its adult lecture series, Literary Elements, tonight at 6:30 with Dino Trackways. It will include information on dinosaur trackways exposed in Arkansas and presented by U of A associate Malcolm Williamson. The event is free. More information available at faylib.org. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for listening. Another new show tomorrow at noon.